Welcome to episode 3 of the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and creator of People Stack Academy, an online school dedicated to helping the tech community build a better people stack. My co-host is Rob Allen. He's an engineering manager at RBM Technologies. And our guest for this episode is Kathy Swody, founding partner at Thrive Leadership. Welcome, Kathy. Welcome, Rob.
Hello.
Pleasure to be here, Jen. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for coming on. So first, I just like to give people a little bit of context so that our listeners know how we know each other, if we know each other. And so first of all, yes, we all do know each other. Kathy and I went to grad school together, so we go way back. And because Rob is my husband and was my boyfriend back then, which is really weird to say, that's when Kathy and Rob originally met, was when we were back at UConn in grad school. So just to get started, Kathy, how about you just introduce yourself and let us know what's going on at Thrive Leadership?
Oh, yeah. So I am currently working on a few different projects over at Thrive Leadership as we get started with 2016. We're working on an engagement survey, looking at where and when people can really thrive at work. We're also coming up with a new Thrive 360 assessment to help leaders get feedback from the people they work closest with, their managers, their direct reports, their peers, in a way that is really user-friendly, that they can digest the feedback very easily and take action where it makes the most sense for them so that they can work really well with their people and get the results that they're looking for. And we're also doing some leadership development programs around emotional intelligence this year. You know, how do you relate to other people? How do you manage yourself? How do you manage other people? As well as mindfulness. We've been getting into, you know, how do we take a break during the hectic world where we get all this information and requests and all sorts of requirements dumped on us? How can we take a break and be really deliberate and focused on our essential priorities? So, you know, a few different things in the mix, but, you know, we're keeping pretty busy.
Yeah, that's great. That's lots of juicy stuff there. So I'm going to dive right in. So in my experience, when I talk with managers, particularly in the tech world, but this seems to be an issue across industries, especially new managers, but even managers or leaders who have been doing what they've been doing for a while, they tell the story about how, yeah, I got promoted and I wanted to move into a leadership position. It was something that I really wanted to do, but I was never really trained in how to do the whole leadership thing. People have even come out and said, yeah, I was promoted, like in the tech world, yeah, I was promoted for my tech skills and not for my people skills. So I'm wondering if this is something that you, that this happens a lot, if you see this happening, and if so, what's your approach to helping these kinds of folks?
Yeah, you know, that is a very common story that I hear. I do hear it a lot in the tech world or in technical positions where there's a certain level of expertise needed to be good at a job, and then people get promoted and it's a great thing. They're talented, they have potential, but they haven't actually been taught. How do you lead people? How do you manage people? How, you know, it's a whole new world. And it's not isolated to tech either. I see this in all sorts of other areas requiring expertise. Doctors, for instance, you know, they don't get taught, you know, there's no courses in medical school on how to manage people, right? How to work with other doctors when you're chief, or lawyers, you know, when they get promoted to partner, you know, so it's amazing how, like, you know, you hear that story across industry, across type. And, you know, it's very common. And, you know, the most important thing when people get promoted or they find themselves in a leadership role is I work with them on the motivation side first. There's no point in doing anything else until they understand why should they learn about people management? Like, why do they need to not keep doing what they've been doing for the last X number of years that got them this promotion? You know, so working with them to understand, well, like, what's the benefit for them? So for example, you know, what's the benefit of delegating, you know, instead of taking it on? Like I hear a lot of people say, well, it's just easier if I do it myself, you know, rather than taking the time to meet with somebody, to delegate it, to then give them feedback, to then, you know, fix it, you know, they'd rather just do it themselves. You know, so what's the benefit of them doing that? You know, so we'll talk, I'll talk to them either in an individual session or, you know, sometimes part of a group session with newer leaders to say, hey, you know, you're going to get back some time here and then you can use this time to do the things that only you can do, you know, like some of the job responsibilities of your new job, you know, some more of the strategic sort of stuff or the bigger picture things, you know, the stuff that you're really, you know, supposed to be working on. And also that they'll get better, it's a better use of their energy, that they're not going to be wasting energy reworking things and going back a lot of times and the dealing with frustrated direct reports and those sorts of things. So getting people really aware of this isn't just a nice to do. This isn't how you're a nice person at work, but there's some real productivity advantages to this.
Right. Right.
For yourself and for the people who work with you.
Yeah, so I think Rob could probably relate to that. Do you want more time and energy at work, Rob?
Sure.
Sure, we all do.
It doesn't come across, though, when you're in it as needing more time and energy. I mean, maybe more time, but probably not the energy thing. It comes across as getting frustrated by how little you can accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
Until you get the team gelled, until you get moving forward, and you start to get those network effects of having that group of people all working toward a common goal. It's more just a general sense of malaise and frustration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you know, in that case, it's a matter of reducing that frustration, and then also helping people, especially when they're new managers, know, hey, it's going to be different when your team gels together, you know, like there's life beyond this frustration. Like this isn't management period, you know, like we're going to get through this and there's going to be a learning curve, you know, as your team comes together, as you gain these skills.
Right. And it's almost like understanding that that is the process, that there's this forming, storming, norming, performing. I think I got them all in there. that there is this storming process, right? That when everybody gets together, that there's going to be some clashing and that that's a natural part of the process. And then you're not necessarily doing anything wrong. You just have to get through that.
Yeah. You know, that's exactly it. And it I think that's very humanizing. If that's a word, you know, for people to realize, hey, it's not just me, but this is part of working with people. You know, it's part of how we interact with each other. And there's a learning curve. And I haven't been formally taught this so far. This was not part of my education to date. But I'm going to learn. I'm going to figure out a way to do that.
Right. Cool. So let's say you've gotten past step one. You've sold them on the what's in it for me. You can see real performance benefits from that. Then what might be the next step after that?
Prioritize and focus. So, you know, leadership is this big amorphous word, or people management. What is this? It can mean any number of things. You know, if someone were to interview all three of us right now, we might even come up with different definitions of what it means in our current roles. And I think for people to take a step back and think about what kind of leader do they want to be? You know, what has worked for them in the past? What are their strengths? And then what are a couple key priorities that they want to tackle first? Where are they going to focus their energy and time on improving? And it's kind of like, it's like New Year's resolutions in a way, right? Instead of people saying like, oh, I'm going to be healthier this year, you know, I want them to say, hey, you know, I'm going to stop smoking. Or, you know, I'm going to try to go to the gym twice a week. You know, I want them to get specific and focused and work on changing a very specific behavior for, let's say, 30 days, 60 days. You know, get that going, turn that into a good habit before they move on to something else. Because the number one mistake, you know, top two mistakes I see with newer leaders is, one, they feel like they have to overhaul everything. You know, they've got to be the perfect leader right away. They beat themselves up and then they get overwhelmed and then they don't do anything. And then it's, you know, kind of very negative situation. Or they think that they can keep doing what they've been doing that got them promoted. And neither works. You know, it's better to take small bites, you know, get specific and focus. So for example, if I were to, you know, let's say work with Rob, you know, Rob, since, you know, you're the tech person here, I'll just use you as an example. You know, I'd say like, hey, what's, you know, what would bring you the greatest advantage, you know, at work? You know, what would, you know, reduce your frustration the most and let you do your best work, you know? And you might be like, hey, you know, I really need some help setting expectations with people when I delegate, you know, and then we'll work on that specific skill. You know, we'll come up with some ways that you might be able to practice that on a regular basis until it becomes habit that you don't even think about it mm-hmm. as you go forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I tend to notice that most leadership folks, especially on the tech side, and I don't know if this is similarly true in the medical and legal fields like you were mentioning before, Kath, but when you get into a crisis situation, the first instinct is to sort of crawl back into where you were last good. If you're in a tech industry, that could mean anything from servers, you know, having a bad time and clients banging on the door, or builds failing and just having to get back on schedule with something, so you go in and start doing code yourself.
Wow.
And that seems to be sort of a default red flag for someone who has left their management role behind because of the crisis.
Yeah, that's an excellent example. And it's human nature in a lot of ways, to a certain extent. When under pressure, when under stress, when we're having a really awful day, we do tend to revert back to where we were good, you know, where our comfort zone was, those old habits, those old ingrained patterns of behavior. So, you know, people get into the weeds, they get into the details, they start coding. I've seen that a lot of times. And that's the inclination is natural, but acting on that inclination is the distinction between somebody who's a healthy manager, a really effective manager, and someone who's getting into some ineffective behaviors. Because, you know, what does the rest of the team feel like when that person comes in and starts coding stuff and taking over pieces of the project that they were supposed to work on? It's dizzying. That's really frustrating for the people who work for that individual.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And so, Kathy, it sounds like it's really about an individualized approach. What are your pain points? What are the habits that you need to form? But one of the things I've been bumping up against in the work that I've been doing is, I want a product. I want a pretty package. Tell me what to do. Tell me how to be a better leader. So what would your response to that be to someone who might say, you know what, I can't afford a consultant, or, you know, that's not something that we can do right now. Are there products or packages out there that can at least get people started, or something similar to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I wish I could say, yes, you know, here's your pretty package if you go to the, you know, it's a little tricky, but I, you know, so I'll address the first part of your question, which I think is really around scalability, right? So I wouldn't want any of the listeners to think that we have to hold hands with the new leader the entire time and really go through this whole process with them. There's ways of streamlining the process, whether it's through webinars or, you know, maybe, you know, a series of in-person workshops where we go over some of the basic guidelines of leadership, you know, some of the communication factors or the, you know, resist the urge to revert back to your old job when, you know, stress hits, and, you know, giving some basic guidelines around that. And the big why behind why those matter. But then during the program, having them do individual reflection exercises to sit back and say, okay, what's really important to you? And maybe even giving them some self-assessments to help guide that process along to point to some areas that they might want to work on. So I guess what I'm saying is I think people need guidance a lot of times, especially in a new role. They need somebody to pull them through. They need a personal trainer, right? So finding a package that I would say meets the organization needs in terms of budget, in terms of getting people together, but also builds an accountability for the individual people to do their exercises to identify what their priorities are, you know, what resources they might need to do that. And by resources, I mean, you know, can they pull on a mentor that they already have? Can they, you know, work in their organizational goals that they're supposed to be working on for 2016 anyway? How can they integrate this into the work they're already doing? So it becomes less of a separate entity, and it becomes baked into their day-to-day work. Because what we're really trying to do is we really want to make this stuff sticky so that they do it, that they stick with the program, and it doesn't become like those New Year's resolutions where they sound really great for a month and then no one remembers what they are anymore.
So you mentioned mentors in there, and I think one of the things that I've observed specifically in tech is that we don't have a large number of public authority figures or role models to sort of cling to. So you're left with who you have direct access to at your workplaces. And many times, some of those people aren't people you want to emulate. And the ones you do want to emulate have this overwhelming sense of imposter syndrome, such that they don't feel that they're qualified to mentor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I like this concept of, I don't know what the right term for it is, but it's like a secret mentor, like a mentor that you haven't actually told them that they're mentoring you.
So they don't even know. It's like double blind. It's like, you're my mentor, but you don't know that you're my mentor.
Right? I know, right? Now, I want to be very cautious. Like, you know, this isn't a big time investment of the mentor, right? So it's not like you're getting, you know, weekly or monthly lunches with this person and they're grooming you for your next job. But it's so rare to find ideal mentors or ideal role models that I often tell people, you know, stop looking for your hero and start looking for specific behaviors that you want to emulate. And so maybe there's one guy you work with who does a really good job presenting, you know, and that's something you want to work on. Well, he becomes your secret mentor, you know. You take notes on what he's doing, maybe not real notes, but, you know, you just note what he's doing, what appeals to you about that style, how it might translate to your own style, that sort of thing. Or you might, you know, look for somebody who does a great job delegating, who seems to have a good handle on their time management, and their people seem to like them pretty well, you know, make some observations as to what that person's doing. And then, you know, as much as possible, see if you can keep up with people external to the organization too. Again, even if it's informally, you know, meeting somebody you used to work with 3 years ago for coffee now and then, just to check in with them and get some fresh ideas as to, you know, how they might deal with their people. So it's kind of like it's a quilt approach, right? So in absence of a perfect mentor, you know, scrap together some stuff, you know, see if you can hack something together.
I like that.
We
because,
can do that.
Yeah, I really do like that, because so few people report having formal mentors. The people that do report wonderful things about it, but most people say, well, you know what, maybe I did have a mentor and maybe they didn't even know about it, but I was watching them and I was, so that's why I also love the idea of emulating behaviors, because those are do this more often, right? That's an easy thing to follow. Follow that direction, do this more often. How do you delegate better? Well, let me just do the kinds of things that this person who I really admire does more.
You can deal with the real examples you see in front of you, and to try them out, experiment with them, see how they work for you. I mean, that's one of the best ways to learn, you know, because it's real practice, and you're not stuck with it. If it doesn't work for you, maybe you tweak it, or maybe you move on to something else. You know, at first this surprised me, and then it started to make more and more sense, and I've seen this time and time again, is people are really receptive to quick phone calls now and then, or quick get-togethers now and then. You pull on their expertise, and you might, where you reach out to someone, you're like, I have a specific question. Could I have 5-10 minutes with you? Like, even if you're standing online at the grocery store, just give me a call. And people are like, oh yeah, sure. Why don't we meet for coffee? And as long as you're polite and not invasive, I've been really amazed at how people like to have their expertise pulled off.
Yeah, you know? They love to have their brains picked, right?
Yeah.
I mean, depending, if the person's a, you know, depending on what they do for a living, they may say something like, well, my pick by brain fee is $200 an hour. But, you know, I've never actually experienced that, especially if it's something really quick or if it's somebody that you already know. And there was a little bit of a hurdle for me getting over that, like asking for people's advice that way. But once you get over it and realize that people are completely fine, like giving advice and talking about themselves, like... like that's, you know, that's a news flash, right? People love talking about themselves. That's really what you're asking them to do, and that you can get extreme value from that, especially if it's somebody that you want to that you look up to and that you want to learn from. So I'm gonna go back a little bit to resources on leadership. In preparation for this conversation, I did a super quick search on Amazon for leadership, and it came up with 180,000 plus results. And I could see how this would be overwhelming, and I've experienced this myself in looking for stuff. Like, there's so much noise out there. How do I find that signal in the noise? I know that, for example, like in the tech world, there's the stuff that Michael Lopp has written. He's known as Rands in Repose. He's written a few books about managing humans and things like that. So people tend to gravitate toward the, oh, he's my guru, he's who I'm gonna follow, and everything else is noise. So that's kind of one way that people approach this overwhelming amount of information on leadership. But given that, I'm wondering if you have suggestions, Kathy. Are there books that you've come across that are really good, reliable, trustworthy resources for people who might be looking for basic pointers or basic frameworks on leadership?
Yeah, that is a great question. And I'm not at all surprised by the Amazon results. I've seen that search before. It's unreal. There's leadership applied to every possible thing. You know, at a certain point, we start to wonder who doesn't have a leadership book out, right? It's almost like parenting, right? There's like 8,000 parenting books, but you want to make sure you're getting something good because we're talking about your people here. You don't want to, you know, get caught in some fads. So my response is two-part. Is one, I'm a big fan of the slow drip of information. So, you know, rather than saying like, hey, here's your Bible of leadership, you know, like, you know, start off with this. I recommend to the people I work with to go to the Harvard Business Review website. They have a tremendous amount of resources, easily digestible, easy to read, quick, usually based in research or some really good conceptual work, and sign up for their, they call it the manager tip of the day. They have a couple other emails you can sign up for. It's free, and they shoot you a quick email every morning with a little nugget of research-based and a tip, you know. So, you know, it might be a tip on active listening. The next day, it's how to give feedback when somebody didn't do the job well. The next day, it's how do you present to your boss? You know, so there'll be various topics, really quick hits. And if you're not into it that day, you just hit delete. It's no problem whatsoever. And so I sign up for it myself. I've been getting them for years. And it's like, yeah, some days I delete them because I got too much going on. And other days I'm like, wow, that's really interesting. I'm going to try that out today. It's really simple stuff. Yeah. They also have, I don't know if you've listened to it, the IdeaCast, which is, they have little podcasts that you can download through iTunes or whatever, or right from their website where they interview authors of books. And you got to think, like Harvard Business School Publishing, they put out a lot of books. And again, they tend to be based in research and some really good thinking. And they'll interview the author, and you get like a quick 10-minute overview of the key points of the book. So I think that's a great way for people to keep up with some great ideas without a big time consumption. You know, I always recommend that people focus on whatever topic they need to be working on. But I find that communication tends to be one of the core things related to people working together, whether it's direct reports, working with your peers, working with your managers. So any investment into how you relate to other people and how you come across other people to be really helpful. So William Ury, he comes out of the Harvard Negotiation Project work. I mean, this is a guy who's negotiated at the Hague. I mean, he's like top notch. And He has a series of books around communication, especially when it's not easy, when there's some type of conflict or confrontation. I recently read a book from him called The Power of a Positive No. And it's about how you, when you need to say no to somebody, but you want to do it in a way that preserves the relationship and keeps everything moving along. And I thought that was a great read. So I would recommend that one. I would also recommend a book called Say This, Not That, A Foolproof Guide to Effective Interpersonal Communication by Carl Alasco. Okay. Yeah. And what I like about that, it's very simple and it's not just about work. So it's got some examples in there that are about, you know, two people getting into a disagreement at home. But what I like about it is it gives you actual dialogue. It actually says, okay, here's the situation. Rather than saying this, you know, here's what you could have said. And I think examples are really good for people, especially as they're starting out, to try on different ways of saying things. I know I found when I was reading the book, I'm like, oh, that's what they meant by saying it that way. Oh, okay, now I get it.
Yeah, I love those specific examples of what to say to people. It just gives you some really actionable suggestions for what to do. And those sound like some awesome resources. And I want to get Rob to jump in on this because in my experience, in the tech world, when you tend to suggest resources, especially if they tend to be academic-y kinds of resources, like, here, read this thing from Harvard Business Review. There's this, oh, they don't know what we're going through kind of thing. So I'm wondering if, I guess, first of all, if you've read any of the HBR stuff or know people who've read the HBR stuff, because it's awesome stuff. And Kathy, I think the great part about it is what Kathy mentioned, is that they're quick articles, they're research-based, but they're very grounded in reality as well. Oh. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. Like, if I were to suggest that to somebody, what the reaction might be or what your reaction is.
I'm going to confirm your bias that the initial reaction would be, they don't know my world. You're giving me a look, and you can't see it on the podcast, but it's... Now, imagine I came to you with advice for how to handle something in an academic bend. So you were talking about something going on at your university, and I share with you an article about how to manage salespeople.
Right.
What's your reaction going to be?
That's too salesy. That's not.
They don't know my world.
They don't. That's not what we do. It's not that context, right?
Right. And yeah. there's a lot in text that makes it feel like a special snowflake.
They don't know us. They don't know what's going on here. So, Kathy, have you experienced this at all? Do you have any folks in the tech world that you work with?
You know, I've worked in tech, but I haven't gotten super deep into tech where that's been the reaction. You know, so it's been more tech within regular, you know, corporations across industries, or it's been more the sales side of the tech world. So yeah, I haven't gotten into, well, you know, it's not quite that. Now the snowflake thing, I can tell you, probably every company I've worked with, they're all very special snowflakes. Every time I give out an assessment to people, you know, they're like, oh, I don't need to listen to this 360 feedback. You know, they don't understand my particular job situation. I'm like, all right, let's put the special snowflake on the side.
All right. So I have a question that came to mind, Kathy, as we were talking. Where do I pull in my IO psychology training? You know, I spent X number of years, 5, 6, 7+ years, depending on, you know, on the person, in getting advanced training in IO psychology. And I know it's there and I know I use it, right? Maybe on a daily basis. But sometimes I feel like it's like this underutilized part of my brain that people won't listen to because it's too, again, going along with the academic-y kind of thing. So I'm wondering where you find that balance or that fit in, you know, bringing in your training as a scientist practitioner in IO psychology.
Yeah, that is a wonderful question. Yeah, and I do bump up against that periodically. And by periodically, I mean pretty often. you know, and I love what I do, and I love the mix of things. And I think, you know, IO plays a role in three ways. is, you know, one, I do a lot of assessments with the people I work with. Oftentimes at the start of a coaching engagement, as part of our leadership development programs, and part of initiatives, we do some type of assessment. And so that, you know, I think the IO part of my brain is, okay, is this reliable? Is this valid? Is this a good tool? What is it actually saying? What can I not say about this? How do you interpret the data? And then helping the person understand that. Two is larger scale data. So looking at the results of what works out of these training programs and looking at change over time in different skill areas and looking to see what's actually improved, looking at changes in engagement or performance or talent retention. You know, sometimes, you know, every so often we get crazy and we're able to do some linkage research, and that's where I feel like I always, you know, having a great time. you know, I think third is, you know, being an informed consumer of what's out there. And that's probably why, you know, some of the Harvard stuff resonates with me, is because it's, as you heard, like, I'm like, it's based in research, you know, it's real. It's not just, you know, somebody on the Huffington Post who's like, let me tell you about last Tuesday, you know, here's my thoughts on life, you know, it's, you know, able to sift through things and be like, okay, that was, you know, like, you know, what's real and what's not, and what's something promising that's worth trying out versus what's fluff. Being able to analyze that, which I don't think we actually had a class on, but I think sitting through all of those courses where we sat through and went through all those articles and talked about research design and what makes a good study and all that sort of stuff kind of trained us to be good consumers.
Yeah, the article dissection, I have fond memories of that. And I'm not saying that facetiously. I love that stuff. I know that not everybody did. But I'm like, oh, what does this sentence mean? What are they trying to say here? What do these analyses mean? Right, right. So assessment, data analysis, and being an informed consumer of content. So that's what the grad schools need to be focusing on. So anybody in grad training programs out there who wants to know what real kind of real world skills, you heard it right here. And I absolutely agree with Kathy that those are things that I use as well. It's in making sense of data and how do we measure things that are seemingly unmeasurable, and convincing people that, yeah, you can actually quantify these things. You just have to take the time to think through what kinds of questions to ask and what kind of scales to use. And then, yeah, being able to know when this is really whatever suggestions that are out there are based on data, are based on research, or is just somebody's idea, and knowing the difference between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a beautiful summary, because there's a lot of stuff out there. You know, the Amazon results are only scratching the surface of what's out there, because that what's on Amazon has actually been published, you know, to some extent. So, yeah, there's a lot out there, and helping people filter that's a really important role that I think that I
yeah. Absolutely. All right. So one final question. One thing that piqued my interest when I was looking through the Thrive Leadership site is I saw you guys have a special program for women leaders and particularly for moms. So can you tell us a little bit more about that and the specific challenges that you've had in designing this program and the specific challenges that you've seen that mom leaders have?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is another area of passion for mine, because I've worked with a lot of leaders who happen to be women, and I noticed that they were having to make some really tough choices and some really tough trade-offs as to whether to pursue their careers or to stay home with this newborn baby that they were expecting. And what struck me was that it wasn't time to make a decision yet for them. You know, they felt like they had to make a decision, but there weren't, for, you know, going back to our conversation about mentors, they, you know, they would point out like, hey, in my organization, there's no real good examples of a leader who happens to be a woman and happens to be a mom. And if there was, you know, so for example, I know somebody, a client of ours who is a very successful senior leader who happens to be a mom, and she gets about, I don't know, 8,000 requests a month, you know, for people to, you know, who want to be mentored by her for that reason. And, you know, I was like, I think there's an opportunity here to connect the two. So we came up with what we call the Leader Mom Panel, where we have women who are high performing, high potential leaders who happen to be moms, and we survey them periodically to find out, well, what's worked for them, what lessons have they learned, what are the key skill sets that have helped them achieve what they needed to, and what has their experience been like? And it's been really interesting because we found that they're really happy doing what they're doing, being a mom, and they love their jobs, and you know, they really take a lot of meaning and pride in that. But at the same time, you know, they're human. It hasn't all been a bed of roses, you know, they don't all have nannies, they don't all have, you know, a significant other at home, but they found ways to make it work, and hearing their stories and giving them a chance to reflect on that has been great for them, as well as for preparing, you know, later generations of people who are looking up and they don't have role models at their organization. So instead they can look at this collective pool of results and see some examples of secret mentors of and some promising practices.
So can you share some of the strategies or practices that you learned from these moms when you collected this data?
Yeah. So, you know, off the top of my head, you know, a few of them are, you know, one, know your value. And that's a gross oversimplification of it, but really understand what you're bringing to the organization and where you're contributing your highest point of value, and knowing where to back off other things. You know, so a lot of times when I'm coaching junior women, they feel like they need to do everything, you know, and I don't want to generalize, you know, by gender, but, you know, because this is, you know, true, I think, of men as well. But I think there's a point where people feel they have to say yes to every request coming across their desk, even if it's something they should be delegating to other people, instead of focusing on the results they're supposed to get and then, you know, blowing those out of the water and then going home and enjoying dinner with their family. And so being able to make some of those trade-offs related to that. And then I think that's the second point, is knowing that there are trade-offs, that there's going to be decisions. You know, are you going to make the conference call or are you going to go to the dance recital? You know, there's going to be trade-offs. How do you make some decision rules for yourself so you're making trade-offs that are helping you feel good about the decisions you're making? You don't feel like they're being forced upon you. Because otherwise, I just saw a TED Talk yesterday that made the point, like, corporations are in the business of making, you know, you give and give and give, you know. So if you don't carve out some lanes for yourself and some trade-offs for yourself, then somebody else is going to make those decisions for you.
Right. Learning how to say no, it's an important skill. It's a hard skill. It's hard. Yeah. It's a hard thing.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Like, what are you saying yes to and what are you saying no to?
Yeah. So Rob, I've seen he's quiet. He's been a little bit quieter than usual, but he has been nodding all along, even as you were just talking about, you know, the challenges that females and moms face. I know, Rob, you've had some female team members, and you have quite a few females who are your direct reports now. So do they talk about these kinds of things? Does this ring true?
No, they're mostly too young to care about such things just yet.
Okay, so not the mom thing, but what about the I have to say yes all the time, or I have to do everything, I have to stay late?
There's two confounding things. So as an organization, the company that I work for prizes sort of results over time in your seat, but also this type of work engenders a certain level of commitment to the final output that all on its own, without any prodding from any corporate governance, sort of makes people want to solve the puzzle and do it in a way that stands the test of time and sort of hones the craft, because it's a very craft-focused sort of discipline. There are people, even at late hours of the evening, that are doing what we would all classify as work.
Yeah.
Now, no one's threatening them, no one's holding a gun to their head, no one's expecting them to get this work done, but being a professional in this industry often means that you do spend extra time making your code that much sharper, that much cleaner, that much better, that much more robust,
yeah.
Mostly because it's, you get into this craft because of, you love what the activity is.
Right.
So even when you're off having fun, and I've got people who are away on vacation who are submitting pull requests because they finally got to go scratch an itch in the code base somewhere that they haven't been able to.
Figured it out. This is how I can reduce it from like 20 lines of code to 5 or whatever.
And solve 12 bugs in the process.
Yeah.
I mean, that's such a huge win for that individual and the company and the code base. Yeah, it's why you don't see a lot of retirees from tech. You see lots of people who tried to retire and failed.
Yes,
not because they ran out of money, but because they wanted to come back and do this work that feels so meaningful again, that scratches that particular itch.
Right.
And I think it's interesting, your word craft. I love that word. You know, that craft. I mean, the meaning is there for people. And the results are real. You know, when they've worked it out, when they figured it out, like there's something substantial there that pulls people in.
Yeah, there's a bit of personal achievement. So it's like beating a video game. And, I mean, we get to feel that daily.
Right.
It's kind of addictive.
Right, and it's such an awesome feeling. You want to keep feeling it over and over again.
Another reason that when you have new managers, they tend to try and sneak back into the code whenever they can.
Right, yeah, that makes total sense, yeah. So we're almost up on time. I do have one more question, and this may be the trickiest question, Kathy. I apologize, but this is how we're going to end it. So if you had one tip for new managers who are trying to make it all work, what would that tip be?
Wow, one tip. Yeah, that's a good one. It's going to sound negative, but let's see. I'll throw it out there and let's see if we can turn it around and make it a positive.
Okay.
All right. So I would say, don't assume that other people want to be managed the way you want to be managed. That's a red flag for me. I'm always like, no. You know, there's some variety out there. So really putting yourself in somebody else's shoes and understanding that, you know, how you like things, how you like to get your communications, how you like to work, how you like to get feedback may not be how everyone else does. So kind of putting yourself in other people's shoes, especially around the feedback piece.
Yeah, I could definitely relate to that and sort of figuring out, it's hard to figure out and get to know the people on your team. I've worked with teams before, and I know Rob has before too, and it's just so easy to default to, this is how I would want to be treated, that I want somebody, like maybe some people like to be micromanaged, right, especially in the beginning, like I want to be told what to do, but other people may not want that, so it really does take time to get to know everybody.
Yeah.
So it's about that time to call it a night for the night, but it's been a great conversation, Kathy. So thank you so much for your ideas and insights and conversation.
Oh, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no problem. And that wraps up another episode of the PeopleStack podcast. Check out my website, jenbunk.com. That's JenBunk.com, where you can find lots of goodies, including a link to PeopleStack Academy, my online school dedicated to helping the tech community build better people processes. Also on jenbunk.com, you can sign up for the Change Log, the PeopleStack weekly email with tips and exclusive offers only available to my email tribe. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.